Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am going to cover Numbers 25, verses 1 through 18, the entire chapter in this audio. We're going to name it The Zeal of Phinehas. This is a chapter in which Moab seduces Israel to immorality and idolatry. Our context is this. We've just finished up with Balaam's seven oracles in the last two chapters, in which he blesses Israel instead of curses Israel. He was invited down from his home in Aram, Syria, to come down to Moab, south, and to curse the people of Israel. The people of Israel are getting ready to cross the Jordan River right north of the Dead Sea. They're east in the Transjordan area in the plain of Moab, and that's where we are now. So we start with Numbers 25, verses 1 through 3. While Israel remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab, for they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor, and the Lord was angry against Israel. Now Israel did this, but we need to remember that they were instigated by Balaam. We read this in Numbers 31:16. Behold, these caused the sons of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to trespass against the Lord in the matter of Peor. The matter of Peor is worshiping the Baal of Peor. Peor was a mountain there in the plains of Moab. And so Numbers 31:16 clearly says that it was through the counsel of Balaam that they did this, which I guess shows that I don't care how precise and accurate a prophet is, because Balaam was. He was very accurate in his prophecies because God was telling him what to say. Nonetheless, you don't listen to a scumbucket. You don't listen to somebody who's made his fortune and fame by communicating with demons. All right, so the Israelites, whose faith in Yahweh was tenuous at best, all through the Exodus we see this, that they wandered 40 years because of their unbelief, not believing that they could conquer the land of Israel, because they believed the reports of the 10 spies, the bad report. Of course, the golden calf incident was not one of their shining hours. They were not strong believers in Yahweh. They were unregenerate people. Now, this Shittim, where Israel is remaining at here in verse 1, this, of course, is on the east side of the Jordan, opposite Jericho, in the plains of Moab there. Shittim wood is acacia wood. Shittim, I think, is the old translation, KJV, but acacia wood, the modern translations have. Shittim wood grew there in abundance on the east side of the Jordan River, opposite of Jericho. Jameson Fawcett Brown says there was a grove of acacia trees lining the eastern side of the Jordan, and Jameson Fawcett and Brown quote Numbers 33:49. They camped by the Jordan from Beth Jeshimoth as far as Abel Shittim in the plains of Moab. All right, well, that's a nice geographical note. The people began to play the harlot. Now, harlot refers not just to sexual immorality. They were engaging, the Israelites were, in the fertility rites of Baal. So this was a double sin, a bad sin. Verse 2, for they, the Moabites, invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods. As John Gill says, these sacrifices were, quote, observed with all the circumstances of joy and pleasure imaginable, and which was very ensnaring, especially to young people. Why is it the young people always get seduced by stuff faster than old people? Is it because they don't have the experience to know that seductive things will kill you usually? I don't know, but it's interesting that Gill pointed that out, and he was writing in the 1800s. I don't think things have changed too much. Now, verse 3 says, Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor. Now, Peor was probably the mountain where this Baal was worshipped, and so that's why they call it the Baal of Peor. Peor was another mountain there in the plains of Moab. Peor was one prominent mountain, and Pisgah was another. Pisgah and Nebo was mentioned, but many people think Pisgah and Nebo were the same mountain. But Peor was a different mountain where they, and on top of that mountain, they had a bunch of altars to Baal, and so it was called Baal of Peor. Adam Clark says, some people say that Baal of Peor was the same as Priapus of the Romans, and I think I pronounced that right. Priapism is when somebody takes some Viagra and can't get an erection to stop after 24 hours or something ridiculous, or weekend or something. Then it gets to be dangerous and you got to go to the hospital. It's named after this lusty god of the Romans. He was worshipped with obscene rites. Well, I don't know. Let's just say Baal. It doesn't matter. Jameson Fawcett and Brown also say that Baal of Peor was also the Moabite national god of Chemosh, who was also a bad god. So anyway, we don't need it. All idolatrous gods are just as evil, just as nasty, and just as stupid. So we go now to Numbers 25, verses 4 through 5. The Lord said to Moses, "Take all the leaders of the people and execute them in broad daylight before the Lord, so that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel." So Moses said to the judges of Israel, "Each of you slay his men who have joined themselves to Baal of Peor." Now, this phrase, "the Lord said to Moses," that's over and over and over again all through the Torah. And usually, probably it means God is speaking to Moses verbally out of the Shekinah glory cloud, which is in the tabernacle and maybe over the tabernacle. And so Moses is probably standing at the door of the tent of meeting. Gill says he was actually in the Holy of Holies. I prefer to think he was at the door of the tent of meeting. Now, the Lord says to Moses to take all the leaders of the people. Now, that could be all the heads of the princes of each tribe, 12 leaders for 12 tribes. In other words, this was high-level executions. It could be. But, of course, you also have family leaders and clan leaders, leaders of 50s, 10s, 100s, and so forth. It could have been them, too. So I'm not really sure what's being said here, but we do know that there is an exemplary execution about to take place. This is serious business. The execution was to take place in broad daylight. Why? The special display of the corpses would warn the people of the consequences of sin, as the NIV Study Bible says. Broad daylight, everybody can see it. This is what happens to you when you eat idol meat sacrificed to Baal of Peor. You're going to die. Now, of course, once they were executed, and the way they kill people in Israel, they would stone them first and then they would hang them up on a gibbet for object lesson purposes. But the corpses had to be removed from the gibbet before sunset, Deuteronomy 21:23. "His corpse shall not hang all night on the tree, but you shall surely bury him on the same day. For he who is hanged is accursed of God, so that you do not defile your land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance." All right, so the sinning, idolatrous Jewish leaders are to be executed in broad daylight before the Lord. Now, what does that mean? Well, before the Lord usually means somewhere near the tabernacle, because the Lord's in the tabernacle in the Holy of Holies in the Ark of the Covenant. So somewhere near the tabernacle, they were executed so that everybody could see in a central place. Verse 5, "So Moses said to the judges of Israel, each of you slay his men who have joined themselves." Now, who are the judges? Well, it could be the tribal leaders I just mentioned, 12 of them. But I think most probably, as Gill and Clark say, that these judges were the rulers of thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens, as was advised by Jethro and set up by Moses in Numbers 18. I'll read Numbers 18, 18 through 21. I'm sorry, I said Numbers. I meant to say Exodus 18, verses 18 through 21. This is Jethro talking to Moses. Jethro is his father-in-law. "Moses, you will certainly wear out both yourself and these people who are with you, because the task is too heavy for you. You can't do it alone. Now listen to me. I will give you some advice, and God be with you. You be the one to represent the people before God and bring their cases to him. Instruct them about the statutes and laws and teach them the way to live and what they must do. But you should select from all the people able men, God-fearing, trustworthy, and hating bribes. Place them over the people as commanders of thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens." And I suspect that's who is being referred to here, as these judges who were the heads of thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. God tells Moses to tell these leaders of thousands, hundreds, and fifties, and tens, "Go out. Anybody under your jurisdiction who has joined himself to Baal of Peor by participating in the idol feast, knock them off, execute them, rub them out." We go now to Numbers 25, verses 6 through 9. "Then behold, one of the sons of Israel came and brought to his relatives a Midianite woman in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the sons of Israel, while they were weeping at the doorway of the tent of meeting." Ah, great timing. Zimri is his name. Verse 7, "When Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, saw it, he arose from the midst of the congregation and took a spear in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel into the tent and pierced both of them through." Zimri's wife was named Cosby. Pierced both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman, through the body. So the plague on the sons of Israel was checked. Those who died by the plague were 24,000. Now notice in verse 6, "Behold," this is the NASB translation. John Gill says that word "behold," it's in the KJV too. It was used because Zimri's act was so incredibly brazen that it warranted the use of "behold." Now, the Holman Christian Study Bible doesn't put it there, I guess because we don't talk that way now, but this was a big deal. Why was it a big deal? Well, Moses had just finished pronouncing death on the idolaters, And then he comes in with a Midianite woman, probably a prostitute, although Clark says it was his wife. But either way, he's joined himself to a pagan right when Moses is denouncing paganism and adultery in front of the whole people. So it was a brazen act flaunted in the face of God's representative, Moses. That's why it says in the sight of Moses. The Midianite woman was carried in there by Zimri in the sight of Moses, where he could see it. As John Gill says, the two, Zimri and Cosby, passed by Moses and the congregation on the way to his tent in an open and undisguised manner. The NIV Study Bible says, quote, "The contempt for the holy things and the word of the Lord shown by Zimri and his lover Cosby is unimaginable." In other words, these people were sinning with a high hand. Now notice that this woman is a Midianite, Cosby is. She's not a Moabite. And you say, well, what's the difference? Well, the Midianites were allied with the Moabites from the very beginning of this sad story. But before we get into that, let's discuss Adam Clark's idea that this was not an act of harlotry, which I believe it was. I think most people believe it was. Clark says, no, that's not true. And here's his quotation. "The condition of these two persons plainly proves it to have been a matrimonial alliance. The one was a prince, the other was a princess. Therefore, I must conclude that fornication or whoredom, in the common sense of the word, was not practiced on this occasion. The matter was bad enough, as the marriage was in flat opposition to the law of God, and we need not make it worse by representing the woman as a common prostitute, as the Vulgate and several others have done. In such a case, this is absolutely inadmissible. Josephus positively says that Zimri had married Cosby. And if he had not said so, still the thing is nearly self-evident." Well, I'm sorry, Adam. It's not self-evident to me. But the scripture does not say she was a prostitute. It just sounds like it. But at any rate, now let's get back to the point of who were the Midianites. This was probably the tribe that was aligned with the Amalekites. Earlier, Numbers 24:21, they were called the Kenites. Mennonites and Kenites, same tribe, different names. And, of course, they're also allied with the Moabites in our story here. And there were some Kenites, of course, who were related to Moses because Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, was a Kenite. But the Kenites were scattered all over the place. And this Kenite, this Midianite, was a bad Midianite because she seduced to idolatry. Now, the fact, John Gill makes an interesting point. He says, is Zimri and Cosby come by. They come by all the people weeping at the door of the tent of meeting where Moses had just made his speech about executing the idolaters. Why were they weeping? Well, John Gill says they were weeping because they were upset with the idolatry. And he says that we need to remember not everyone partook of the sin with the Moabites, which is true because not all of them were killed. Only 24,000 were. So they might have been weeping over their fellow Israelites' idolatry, but they could have been weeping because they were guilty and weeping because of all the hangings. Now, I'm not sure whether the hangings had been carried out yet, but they had been pronounced at least, so maybe that's what they were weeping over. But at any rate, they were crying, and this was a very emotional situation. Now, Phinehas is introduced in verse 7. Phinehas is the son of Eleazar. Eleazar is the second surviving son, the third son of Aaron, the first oldest surviving son. And he's now got to be the high priest because Aaron's died. And so Eliezer's the high priest. In fact, he held the high priesthood all the way up through the Old Testament. His family did, except for 150 years when his brother Ithamar's family held the high priesthood. So Eliezer's a big name in Israel, and Phinehas is his son. Now in verse 8, Phinehas, having grabbed a spear, goes into the tent of Zimri and stabs Zimri and Cosby through. That means he stuck them like a shish kebab through the body. Now, apparently they were having sex together while he did it. So he caught them in flagrante delicto, as the lawyers like to say. But it doesn't actually say that. That's just a speculation. Gil believes that. I believe it too. At any rate, as we'll see later, Phinehas is greatly honored for this, given the covenant of peace with God. Now, another question that arises here. Was Phinehas' act extrajudicial? Did he just decide to do this on his own as vigilante justice? Remember, the plague is spreading, and he wants to stop the plague, and so he stabs him real quick-like. Well, let's look, first of all, at the exigent circumstances. If they had waited for a trial of Zimri, half of Israel would have been dead. And Phinehas could not have been blamed by God because the Lord stopped the plague after the killings, thus showing he was pleased with the execution. Now, This is a dangerous case, as Gill and Clark both point out. This cannot be a precedent for vigilante executions. It was justified only by the pressing exigencies of the case. That's reasonable. But you know, it might not have been an extrajudicial act at all. Phinehas was the grandson of the high priest Aaron and the son of the current priest Eleazar. He was not merely a private person, as John Gill points out. He was a man of public authority. And he might have been one of the judges that Moses had earlier ordered to slay the idolaters, as we read about in a previous verse. So Phinehas might have just been carrying out orders. But at any rate, he didn't do anything wrong. God is very serious about idolatry, because idolatry with these people would have wiped them out. So the plague on the sons of Israel was checked after Phinehas did that. And in verse 9, we see that those who died by the plague were 24,000. That's a lot of people. But still, there were over 600,000 Israelite men, so I assume that the 24,000 that were killed were men that died by the plague. It doesn't say that. I would think they would be men, because the men are the responsible for the idolatry. They led the women. With right goes responsibility. But it doesn't say that. Now, this 24,000 introduces an interesting problem because, well, first of all, let's point out the magnitude of this. Remember Korah's rebellion in number 16? Decided he wanted to be the high priest, and so he rebelled. He was a Levite of the tribe of Kohath, if I remember correctly. In that rebellion, 14,700 people died. We know that from number 1649. And here, 24,000 people, about 11,300 more people died. That's a lot of folks. Now, the interesting problem that I said arises from this number comes from the fact that the Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 10:8 that 23,000 fell, not 24,000. 1 Corinthians 10:8, now, nor let us act immorally, Paul says to the Corinthians, as some of them did, meaning the people in Israel, and 23,000 fell in one day. So we've got a discrepancy of 1,000, a difference here. 24,000 in Numbers, 23,000 in 1 Corinthians. Why the discrepancy? Well, I'm going to give you four options to reconcile, two of which I think are weak, one I think is not very encouraging, and then one I think is the best one. I give you the best one first, and many commentators hold to this. It says in Numbers 24, verse 9, 25, verse 9, that 24,000 fell by the plague. And so what this means, according to Gil Clark and Matthew Poole, 1,000 were executed, but only 23,000 fell by the plague. And Paul is just referring to the people who fell by the plague, not by the 1,000 who were executed. Now, I immediately detected a problem with that, because if you read Numbers 25:9, it explicitly says that 24,000 fell by the plague, not by execution. And so I was prone to dismiss this option. However, it turns out that the Hebrew word used for plague can also mean by the hand of God or a sudden stroke. Here's what the commentator Benson said, quote, "What we render plague does not signify pestilence only, but any other sudden stroke." And here's what the commentator Poole said, "The word being used, as oft it is, for the sword or hand or stroke of God." So 24,000 people died by the hand of God or by the stroke of God. Well, that would include the plague and the judicial execution. So Paul is just quoting the people that fell by the plague. He didn't mention the judicial executions, and I think that reconciles it pretty good. Here's a quote from Colin Delitzsch, quote, "Well, Paul used, quote, a traditional interpretation of the schools of the scribes, according to which 1,000 were deducted from the 24,000 who perished as being the number of those who were hanged by the judges, so that only 23,000 would be killed by the plague." Now, since Paul was a rabbinic scholar, he very likely used rabbinic sources, either in his memory or in his study with his books. And so that's probably what he was doing, quoting, using the rabbis. Well, that's the easiest way to resolve it. But here's some other suggestions. Option number 2, Adam Clark mentions that some manuscripts of 1 Corinthians 10:8 have 24,000. Well, that doesn't prove anything to me. It just might easily mean that the New Testament scribes changed the number in Corinthians to match the number in Numbers. So what does that prove? Third possible way to reconcile the numbers is from the Cambridge commentary. Paul may have used a textual variant. Of course, Paul used the Septuagint. Septuagint has there's no difference. The Septuagint has 24,000. But maybe there was a textual variant of the Septuagint that had 23,000. That's Cambridge suggestion, Cambridge commentary. I don't go for that. Fourth option. This is from Ellicott and Poole and others. Paul mentions 23,000 who fell in one day. The other 1,000 fell on a different day. Let me read 1 Corinthians 10:8 again. Nor let us act immorally as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in one day, Paul says. Well, the idea here is Paul is just mentioning the highlight of the executions or the deaths in one day, but he didn't mention the other 1,000 which were on another day by the plague also. Well, I think that's kind of weak. I think the best thing is Paul is using rabbinic sources that just dealt with those who fell by the plague and not those who were executed. We go down to Numbers 25, verses 10 through 13. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, has turned away my wrath from the sons of Israel, in that he was jealous with my jealousy among them, so that I did not destroy the sons of Israel in my jealousy. Therefore say, Behold, I give him my covenant of peace, and it shall be for him and his descendants after him a covenant of a perpetual priesthood, because he was jealous for his God and made atonement for the sons of Israel. Atonement means a covering of sin. It means making a unhappy God, a wrathful God, friendly again. It means to propitiate his wrath, in other words. It means to reconcile one to God. That word atonement has a lot of rich meaning, which we sort of understand. We read it so much. It's like we just say forgiveness. Well, yeah, but it's a little bit deeper than forgiveness, although that's involved. All right, so the Lord spoke to Moses again, probably out of the cloud of the tabernacle, verse 10. Verse 12 says that God gave Eleazar a covenant of peace. That would be external peace. Eleazar is not going to be conquered, and his family is not going to be conquered by war, because it went for Eleazar and his descendants after him, both. And also internal peace, no guilt, friendship with God. Now, this covenant of peace would be a covenant of a perpetual priesthood, as it says in verse 13. Now, that word perpetual is used a lot in the Torah, and it doesn't mean until all eternity. It means until the Messiah came. Adam Clark says it means this covenant of peace with Eleazar is a covenant of a perpetual priesthood that lasts through all eternity, in which case Eleazar's priesthood would have to be taken over by Jesus or fulfilled by Christ. I don't think so. I think he's just talking about as long as the Old Testament system lasts, Eleazar would be a priest. And even then, it doesn't mean all the way through, because although Eleazar's family held the priesthood from the time that Aaron died all the way up into the Maccabean period, there was a 150-year period. There was a 150-year period in that stretch of time in which Ithamar, Eleazar's younger brother, held the priesthood. Eli's family, for example, Eli and Samuel fame, Eli's family was from Ithamar. Eleazar's family got the priesthood back in the person of Zadok the priest in 1 Chronicles 6:50, and they had it ever since, maybe not definitely, but maybe even until the time of the Maccabees. Adam Clark says it was unclear who had the priesthood in the time of the Maccabees. That's probably because they were buying and selling it so fast it was hard to keep up with it. But the point is that Eleazar, because of what Phinehas did, Eleazar's family was blessed with a high priesthood for most of the Old Covenant era for stabbing Zimri and Cosby in their illicit relations. We go now to Numbers 25, verses 14 through 18. Now the name of the slain man of Israel who was slain with a Midianite woman was Zimri, the son of Salu, a leader of a father's household among the Simeonites. The name of the Midianite woman who was slain was Cosby, the daughter of Zur, who was head of the people of a father's household in Midian. Now, being heads of households, both the man and the woman, that shows that they were prince and princesses. They were big shots in their respective countries. Verse 16, Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Be hostile to the Midianites and strike them, for they have been hostile to you with their tricks, with which they have deceived you in the affair of Peor and in the affair of Cosby, the daughter of the leader of Midian, their sister who was slain on the day of the plague because of Peor. Now, Zimri was mentioned as belonging to the Simeonites. He was a leader among his father's household, leader of a family amongst the Simeonites. Why was the name mentioned? I think it was just to identify him. John Gill says, he wants to shame him because he wants to shame the Simeonites because of what the Simeonites did in their patriarchal history several hundred years before. You recall when they just come to Shechem, Abraham did, and one of the Shechemites, I forgot his name, I think his name was Shechem, violated Dinah, their sister, and so Simeon, the Simeonites, along with the Reubenites, if I recall correctly, they said, hey, we'll let you marry our daughter, our sister Dinah, but you got to be circumcised. And so the Simeonites, and so the Shechemites circumcised themselves. And while they were sore from having their penises cut, the Simeonites went in and the Reubenites and wiped them out, which of course gave Jacob a very bad name. He became a stench in that area and had to get out of town. So the Simeonites were not exactly, did not have a good history. Well, that's nice, but I don't think that that's why they're mentioned here. I just think it's mentioned to identify who this Zimri is. Now, he was a head of a family, so he was prominent. And Cozbi was a prominent woman, the daughter of Zur, and Zur was a head of the people of a father's household in Midian. So Zur was a big shot, and the big shot's daughter just got executed. Well, you know what that means. That means the Avenger of Blood is going to come after the person who executed her. That didn't stop Phinehas for a minute. He wasn't concerned about the rank or quality of the person, about the number of redeemers, blood redeemers that are going to come after him. There would be a lot of Avengers of Blood for a high-ranking person, but old Zimri, Phinehas did not care. He went ahead and carried out his deed of execution. Now, the woman is a Midianite, not a Moabite, but a Midianite. And you say, well, why is this put here in the section with Moab? It's because the Midianites had been in league with the Moabites, and Balak, the head of the Moabites, from the very beginning of the confrontation with the Moabites. We read in Numbers 22:4, Moab said to the elders of Midian, now this horde, the Israelites, will lick up all that is around us, as the ox licks up the grass of the field. And Balak, the son of Zippor, was king of Moab at the time. Dropping down to verse 7 in Numbers 22. So the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the fees for divination in their hand, and they came to Balaam and repeated Balak's words to him. So the Midianites were in knee-deep, neck-deep with the Moabites, and so that's why Cozbi is mentioned here. I won't go into the detail here, but if you go back to Numbers 22, as John Gill relates, this is what the Midianites did. They were the first that advised to send for Balaam, and then Balaam stayed with the Midianites and was entertained by the Midianites. And then, of course, the Midianites listened to Balaam when he suggested the scheme of seduction. I don't know how much of that Gill can prove by scripture, whether he's just speculating, I don't know. But the point is the Midianites were joined with the Moabites. Now, why were the Israelites not also to be hostile to the Moabites? In verse 17, we see this, be hostile to the Midianites. Israel, Moses, be hostile to the Midianites and strike them. But there's nothing that says about, God doesn't tell Moses to be hostile to the Moabites and strike them and kill them. Why? Well, it's because for the sake of Lot. Remember, Moab was descended from Lot. Lot's eldest daughter got Lot drunk and then had sex with him. It's kind of disgusting in the cave at Zoar after the catastrophe at Sodom and Gomorrah. You know the story. We read in Deuteronomy 2:9 this, then the Lord said to Moses, do not harass Moab nor provoke them to war, for I will not give you any of their land as a possession, because I have given Ar to the sons of Lot as a possession. So Israel was not to conquer Moab, and they didn't. They got the former territories of Ammon up there in Gilead, in the Transjordan area, and all the way up there east of the Sea of Galilee and Bashan, but they didn't get the country of the Moabites. Now, David did make them tributary to them, but they never really took over Moab. And God said in Deuteronomy 2:9, you're not going to get Moab. You're not going to harass them. And this was so ironic. Balak, the prince of Moab, is going to all this trouble to curse the Israelites when all he had to do was say, go be warm, be filled, be in peace, and be happy, and come around our land and cross the Jordan River. Just leave us alone. And Moses would have left him alone. But even though God told Moses not to harass Moab, and he didn't say strike them and be hostile to them as he told Moses to be to the Midianites, God was nevertheless not happy with the Moabites, because we read in Deuteronomy 23:3, no Ammonite or Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of their descendants, even to the 10th generation, shall ever enter the assembly of the Lord. Now in verse 17, Moses is told to strike the Midianites. That's actually recorded in chapter 31, which we're going to talk about when we get there. We haven't gotten there yet. And we are now finished with chapter 25, The Zeal of Phinehas, verses 1 through 18. In our next audio, we'll look at the census of the new generation. A new census is taken. That will be in Numbers 26. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.